At Ability Chiropractic, we believe every child deserves to grow up healthy, strong, and connected to the incredible power within their own body. From infants to adults, our doctors specialize in purposeful chiropractic care that restores balance between the brain and body, helping you and your family live and heal the way you were designed to, naturally. Families across Columbus are choosing to build lifelong wellness from the start. Discover what true health feels like at Ability Chiropractic. Schedule your visit today at abilitychiro.com.
Hello, we are transmitting to you from our present, which we can only assume is your distant past, the turbulent time that was the early 21st century. Fearing the great cataclysm that will surely befall our civilization, we began this monumental reference of strange and obscure human knowledge. These recordings represent our attempt to compile and preserve wonders and esoterica that would otherwise be lost. Whether you're listening from an advanced civilization or have just reinvented the technology to decrypt our transmissions, this is our legacy to you. This is our time capsule. This is The Omnibus.
You have accessed entry 688. .DE2203, certificate number 43383, Jack Kirby's Lost Art.
What do your characters represent?
Well, the characters represent a sort of a transcendent feeling that we all have inside us, that we could do better. We want to do better.
So, Joe, where are you coming to us from?
From Provo, Utah. I'm at BYU right now.
Oh, you are. You seem a little bit, I mean, not to judge you on your appearance, because everyone in Utah lives a hard life, I know. It's the mountain air and the unrelenting sun, but you seem like you're not a student. Am I right?
Yes, I'm in the English department here. I thought, as you're transitioning away from Ken, you might want a white middle-aged man with ties to BYU to help ease that journey.
So did you come to the Omnibus program through an affiliation with the Church of Latter-day Saints?
So I host a podcast called the Protagonist Podcast, and an early guest mentioned that one of their podcasts was the Omnibus Podcast. It was right as you were starting the Omnibus Podcast.
Yeah.
And I'm like, well, I'll go give that a listen. And I've listened, since then. So I've been with you from very close to the beginning.
Oh, great. Great. Good news. Well, we have a lot of good friends in Utah. And in fact, recently I had a doctor contact me from Provo, who said, I understand that you've got some issues with your own doctor, and I'd like to just be your Provo doctor at a distance. He said, I'm not an MD, I'm a doctor of nursing, but being a doctor of nursing is like being a nurse of doctoring. And so he's been prescribing me medicine online. And a lot of my friends are like, are you sure you should be just taking medicine that arrives in the mail from someone who claims to be in Provo, Utah? And I said, would a false doctor claim to be from Provo? Wouldn't they claim to be from, like Carnegie Mellon or something? Like, what an unlikely thing to lie about. Well, so tell me about you. How long have you been teaching at Provo?
So my wife and I have both worked here. And so for a while I was part-time adjuncting, then I was visiting full-time, and now I'm full-time in the English department here, at Brigham Young University. And I do American literature and American culture, for the English department. So I get to teach the fun stuff like comic books and, film and television, as well as, the survey course of American literature.
Are you tenured?
No, I am now what's their version of tenure track, but I'm at the beginning of that process because of that time being adjunct and then full-time but visiting, which is not tenure track, and now I'm on their version of tenure track.
Right. Well, good. I wish you all the tenured luck.
Thank you. it takes some luck.
Explain to me, when I was in college, there was, which was a long time ago, but there was not really pop culture as, you know, that was considered, say, for instance, literature, mm-hmm. graphic novels, comic books. I'm sure this was probably true when you were in college. So what's changed in the intervening years that we're taking these media not only more seriously, but we're kind of recognizing them as being equivalent to what we would have thought of as the literary canon?
Yeah. So there, I mean, there's a few key figures in academia that kind of pushed for this, figures like Russell Nye and a guy named Brown and Gary Hoppenstand. They kind of said, we need to be looking at this not just as key parts of American culture, but this is now like the common culture that we're all consuming. And that may have more of an impact on our larger society than the, you know, the high canon of media. And so considering what is being consumed by a larger swath of people, even if it's not considered as artistic as, you know, the Pulitzer Prize winning novels, might be worth doing within the academic setting. And there's always pushback and argument about, you know, what can and should be studied in the university. And you can like track some of the lags of like, okay, we kind of accepted comic books and now we're kind of accepting video games. Like there's always like this lag of, you know, as it emerges and becomes widely embraced within the culture, there's this timeline of okay, when do the first studies about that thing start coming out? When do the first classes focusing on that, you know, start coming out? And when does it become, you know, accepted as its own, area of study? And of course, there will always be people who, you know, harumph and say it should only be the stuff that's been in the canon forever is all that we really need to study in academia.
Yeah, I feel that way about modernist literature and impressionist art. How dare they? How dare they yes. bring this modern balderdash into the colleges? So when you're looking at comic books as literature, let's say, or video games as literature, are you still using the kind of academic template that you would use to study a book or study, say, a great film? Or is the mm-hmm. is the template also kind of morphing to accommodate the new media? Like, I'm not sure how you would study a video game, which is interactive. You know what I mean?
Yes, exactly. So there are definitely like overlaps. Like we borrow some of the visual rhetoric and visual analysis from art and film to talk about comic books and video games, because there are places where they overlap. But there are affordances to each medium that are unique, like the interactivity of the video game or the panel layout of comic books and how those get consumed. That also become part of like, okay, we need to address this formalist side of the media that is differentiates it from other existing media, you know, that a lot of schools of analysis have already existed. So there's definitely that move to look at what is different or unique about these as they emerge and come out. But then you also absolutely do still apply some of the traditional schools of literary theory, you know, whether it's new historicism or Marxism, or, you know, we look at those as lenses to analyze the media as well.
Right. I can imagine The Watchmen being like, for instance, a very fertile ground for literary criticism, right? A lot of references there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. Very, you know, postmodern in its interconnectivity to other media and its referentiality and self-referentiality to itself and its medium, but also to other works of literature. So yeah, you can absolutely dig into some classic literary theory there, but you'll also find people who are looking at how the story is being told in the comic book medium, not just like what the story is. Like there's, you know, narrative studies, of course. You know, what are the themes? What a, you know, and, right. You know, how does this reflect, you know, society at that time? What is the commentary that it's giving? But it is also like, okay, well, how are they using this 9-panel grid in Watchmen to tell this amazing, you know, right. piece of storytelling?
Right. Which is kind of, the analogs to film in that sense, the framing and so mm-hmm. forth. But when you're dealing with, because you're not simply a pop culture professor, you're also teaching intro to lit. Like, yeah. How do you compare the response to, or the response from a room full of freshmen when you're talking about what I assume is Travels with Charlie or Cannery Row, and then in the other class you're talking about the Dark Knight. Like, what's there? Is there a comparable engagement?
Oh, it's different types of engagement, different types of energy. Like when I say, like, we're teaching a class on the graphic novel Mouse, you know, Art Spiegelman's Mouse, this classic, you know, that's considered a, you know, now part of the American literary canon. When I say we're going to spend the whole semester talking about Mouse, there's also this trepidation of, like, I don't know how to talk about comics. Like, I've been trained as a student that came through the American public education system and have done intro to English. I've been trained how to talk about poetry and novels and short stories. I have not been trained how to talk about graphic novels. So we have to take some time to, like, talk through the jargon and, you know, the unique aspects of the comic book form before they're able to start doing their analysis. And then it's obviously going to be a very different type of analysis. And same when I talk about film, you know, I teach a class on film, and a little bit of the time is like, okay, I've got some ideas, but I just don't know how to talk about this yet.
Right. Right. Well, and I imagine, I mean, this is one of the things about universities that always, it's not that it frustrates, but it certainly has been noted over and over and over that universities tend to be siloed, and that, mm-hmm. you know, literature teachers and art teachers don't collaborate, let alone literature teachers and biology teachers. Mm-hmm. And there's so much potential energy and so many opportunities that it feels like are just year after year squandered because there isn't that collaboration that happens between disciplines. And has it occurred to you, or is it even possible at your school to get a graphic arts teacher to kind of co-teach it with you?
I haven't done that, but they do have a program that's very specifically about, like, we want to pair experts in different disciplines to talk about a text. Like, I know someone from the English department and someone from the biology department co-taught a class that in part, like, talked about Frankenstein. We're going to talk about,
That's awesome.
Yeah. You know, both the scientific side of it, what's going on? Why was there this fascination with reanimation and energy at that time? Where was science at when Mary Shelley was writing this? But mm-hmm. you know, also then the literary side of it all. And so I'm, like, new enough, I haven't done that, but I think it would be really a fertile area, like you're saying, to be able to do that. I mean, but there's also, like, this whole issue of, you know, I'm housed in the English department, but there's someone that's talking about, you know, comic books that's also housed in, you know, the humanity, you know,
I love that phrase, by the way, you're housed there. That's just feels yes. like kind of appropriate. Well,
it's the siloing that you're talking about. And sometimes it's like, why don't we have more interaction? But I know people who study comic books at other universities that may be in the communications department, you know, for right. whatever reason, that's, you know, where they ended up.
Right. Yeah, well, you know, my experience as a comic book reader, of course, started in the early 70s, and that was a heyday for, as I'm sure you know and probably will be telling us, like a time where now I look back through the lens of people, basically through the lens of people telling me, and realize, like, this was some kind of golden age of comics. But when I was a kid, I did not, for whatever reason, did not respond to superheroes. And a lot of my peers, of course, really did, but somehow I couldn't, the muscly people maybe in the drawings, mm-hmm. like I wasn't, attracted to or fascinated by muscles or power in that way. And so the comic books that I read as a kid were Richie Rich, Casper the Ghost, mm-hmm. Donald Duck and his nephews, Scrooge McDuck and his nephews. And then as I got older, I got into Mad Magazine.
Yeah.
And then the comic books that I read changed to, like, Sergeant Rock and these World War II comic books about tanks that were, it turns out they were all ghosts or whatever, you know.
The Haunted Tank, yeah.
The Haunted Tank. And then from Mad, I kind of got into alternative comics, which also, this was a real heyday, my childhood heyday for the Freak Brothers and all of the
underground comics with an X, right?
That's right. So I really missed superhero comics almost entirely. I did read Spider-Man because Spider-Man was both funny and also relatable. He was a teenager and he wasn't muscular or, you know, macho in any way. And I think maybe the comic book that freaked me out, I was given, it was a birthday party and everybody got a comic book. All the kids got a comic book. I was probably 6 or 7. And the comic book I got was The Silver Surfer. And The Silver Surfer was surfing through outer space on a silver surfboard. And the entire comic book, as far as I could tell, was just him with giant speech bubbles, like going on these philosophical, like elaborate, uncomprehensible to me, philosophical discourses. And I felt like, well, all of these comics are, they're not just hard to parse. They are, they're like intentionally unreadable. It was like reading the Foundation trilogy, but as a 6-year-old.
Yeah.
So anyway, I'm going to be a pretty dumb companion for you today. At one point in the 2010s, a friend of mine bought me the Jack Kirby Omnibus, a massive collection of Jack Kirby.
More than 1,000 pages, I'm sure.
Incredible. And, you know, Ken Jennings has a wall of comics that would blow your mind. It's as big as your own bookcase. But I looked at it, and again, I could not engage. So there must be something, and maybe you see this in your classes. Have you thought of what it is in the psychology of a young person that makes them prefer one kind of comic to another, one sort of cultural? I know I was the outlier as a little kid in 1977, but does that ever come up that you have some students that are just so engrossed in others that just couldn't care?
Yeah. Like, I mean, there's obviously genre preference in all the media that we talk about. And even when I talk about graphic novels, there are some students who have been like hardcore superhero fans, you know, can give you all the lore of the history of the companies, you know, and their characters. And there are some students who are just like, superheroes just never do it. Like, but like Art School is Mouse. Like, I found that one really interesting. I didn't know this could be done in comics. And now I'm kind of fascinated with this type of graphic novel, but definitely not that other one that we associate with the comic book medium so frequently.
Yeah, I loved Mouse when it first came out. It blew me away. I read it over and over. And the guy who did those comics about the war in Bosnia,
Let's see, it's not Joe Sacco.
Joe Sacco's comics definitely connected with me too. They're all around here somewhere. Well, anyway, so yeah, I mean, I think that the graphic novel. So again, not to give you too much of my backstory, but would have been my freshman year in college. I wasn't in college at the time, but that was the year I think that The Dark Knight came out. Mm-hmm. And it was also the year that Wolverine and the X-Men, there was some major development in that comic book series. Yeah. And I remember seeing The Dark Knight for the first time. I was at Johns Hopkins sitting in a dorm, and somebody kind of came in and plopped it down on the bed and said, "You've got to check this out." And it was the first superhero comic that just really connected with me. It was such a beautiful piece of art. And I'd never seen superheroes kind of in that light, portrayed with all that darkness and all that. I think when I look back at the Jack Kirby stuff, maybe that's all in there. You're probably about to explain. But that was a moment too, right? In the late 80s, mid-80s, I guess.
Mid-80s,
kind of turning point.
Oh, yeah. That's often cited as like a point of maturation of the medium between Watchmen and The Dark Knight and Mouse, you know, all those things happening where we see a different type of story emerging in American comic book storytelling. But we're talking about Jack Kirby, which goes, you know, way before his career, goes back to the very early days of American comic books. And
Pogo, or do you mean before that? Do you mean like comics in broadsides?
So we had newspaper comic strips before we got to the comic book, and then we get the comic book in the mid 30s, and Jack Kirby's going to start working in the late 30s on American comic books.
No way, he's that old?
Yeah, he's going to co-create Captain America in 30, let's see, or that might be 41. Let me go double check the exact year that he co-creates Captain America. But it's before America enters the war. Wow. And on the cover of Captain America number one, which is by Joe Simon and Jack Kirby, Captain America is punching Hitler in the face.
Before the war.
Yeah, before America entered the war. And you know, anytime anyone says, like, my entertainment didn't used to be political, I think you just didn't understand the politics, because entertainment has always been political.
I mean, there's something pretty, like, on the face of it, political about punching Hitler.
Yeah, this was in 1940 that the issue came out. And, you know, the reports and the lore are that they got hate mail from isolationists who thought this was too provocative, and that Jack Kirby offered to fight any of the isolationists who were angry. They could come have a fist fight with him.
Now, I know a lot of the early comic book artists were Jewish. Was Jack Kirby Jewish? He was.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. He is part of that. There's a very close tie between, you know, Jewish immigrants and children of Jewish immigrants in the American comic book industry. I think his birth name was Jacob Kurtzberg, and he went by Jack Kirby. He had a number of pen names before he settled on Jack Kirby. He does, I know that in one biography, at least, he pushes back against the idea that he was trying to make his name sound less Jewish. He was just, I think he says he liked that it sounded like James Cagney.
And yeah, so pretty macho name, Jack Kirby.
Yeah.
Pretty rad.
Yes.
So is there much scholarship? I mean, what is the consensus about why so many Jewish Americans or that the comic book kind of came out of that culture? I know, Michael Chabon's book, which I really enjoyed, kind of covers this. But what's the academic side of this?
So part of it is that at the time, the most reputable version of doing this type of art would have been newspaper comic strips, and in part, you might be denied access to that if you were Jewish. And there's the newer emerging field that doesn't yet have those kinds of gatekeepers. And when many of the early publishers and those that are engaging in the comic book industry are Jewish, it's an open door for Jewish talent to come there. And that door is not open in every other type of, you know, entertainment media.
There's no precursor in Central European culture that would have sort of suggested comic books as a way of expressing.
No, so the comic books are generally identified as an American art form, that this emerged in America. There's some early predecessors. There's a Swiss man named Rudolf Topfer, who many say is like the father of the comic, and he kind of has like the first rectilinear story progression of we're going from panel to panel, left to right, but it doesn't have all the grammar of comics that we come to know. The first comic book isn't going to come till the mid-1930s, and that is originally just reprinting newspaper comic strips. They just kind of flip the newspaper on its side, rearrange the panels, and put a staple in the middle and fold it over, and they some publisher decides, we know that the comic strips are extremely popular in newspapers, so why don't we just sell those individually? And everyone's like, that is a stupid idea, because they've already read them. No one's going to rebuy entertainment that they've already consumed. And then once they give that option, it is immensely popular. So of course there's imitation, and then you start to see original material. Just a couple, you know, like a year later, you start to see and a lot of that original material, stuff that had been rejected by the newspapers. They go through like the slush rejects. I'm like, okay, well, we'll pay you a cheaper rate if you let us publish this in this new comic book form.
Right. Yeah, my daughter has read every Calvin and Hobbes 14 times. So an enduring appeal.
Yeah, that newspaper comic, Calvin Hobbes in particular, still is evergreen. That one is still, you know, sells very well in its collections, even though it's only, you know, 10 years of content.
Right. If you think about how much the early Peanut stuff feels very located in mid-century America, but Calvin and Hobbes has it still feels kind of classic, but so broadly classic that it does feel a little eternal.
Mm-hmm.
Except for the lack of electronic gizmos, but you know.
Yeah, but it just really captures something like honoring childhood imagination within it that I think still, like, every kid that comes across is like, yeah, this is the stuff. This is it right here.
Well, so comic books explode and they are what, pretty quickly considered degenerate? When does the degeneracy or that accusation come into the culture?
So they quickly become mass culture. There's some arguments that, more people were engaging with comic books as media than almost any other time for a little bit there in the late 1930s and early 1940s. And then a lot of the artists like Jack Kirby does go fight in the war. A lot of the people that were working in the industry go in World War II. They're gone, but then they come back and it's kind of like, well, this is what we're going to do. They do find that superheroes have faded from popularity. Some of the argument is that they had wrapped themselves so much in the propaganda efforts. You know, it's Captain America and, you know, Superman, Batman, and Wonder Woman are shown fighting, the Axis powers on covers. And those are all being shipped overseas to soldiers that when the war's done and people are kind of like want a breath, it's like, well, the superhero genre isn't really what we're looking for. That kind of became very closely associated with the war effort. So it shifts to whatever other genre can prove popular. So Jack Kirby is also credited with inventing romance comics. He's like, let's give this a try.
What, really?
He and Joe Simon, who co-created Captain America, they go and co-create the first romance comic book. It is like whatever genre will work. And the genres that they find in the late 40s and early 50s that are going to sell the best are crime comics and horror comics. And that's when really there becomes this association of like, oh, wait, the juvenile delinquents are the ones reading the crime comics. They're going to read those to learn how to do crimes. There's kind of a boogeyman in the comic book industry, a man named Frederick Wortham, who leads a crusade against comic books, arguing that reading comics causes juvenile delinquency in a book called Seduction of the Innocent. And he really, promotes this book through like housekeeping magazines and, you know, housewife magazines and on radio shows that are targeting housewives, and makes this kind of moral panic about the comic book industry, that it's corrupting the youth of America in the 1950s.
When it turned out, really, the corrupting influence was video games, and we just had to wait another generation.
Yeah. Well, rap music first, then video games. Right, we just had to wait. Rock and roll before rap, you know.
Well, let me ask you this. You know, romance novels are such a massive industry. Mm-hmm. And we think of comic books as being very boy identified. And if one of the first new genres after the war was romance comics, why do you think it is that comics didn't catch on with young girls who were looking for romance narratives, but they did catch on with boys that wanted crime narratives?
Well, it does for a time. Like romance is going to outsell superheroes for that period. It's just when the industry, so after this moral panic, and it's very similar to what we see with Hollywood during, the Hayes Code panic, where the government kind of threatens to censor Hollywood, and Hollywood says, no, we'll police ourselves, and they create the Hayes Code. The comic book industry is going to have government hearings and the government's going to threaten to censor the comic books. And the comic book industry says, no, we'll censor ourselves, and they create the Comics Code Authority. That's going to forbid things like the word, terror in the title or horror in the title. You can't have zombies. You can't have vampires. You can't have werewolves, for a time. And the industry is going to like be looking for what to do that can be safe and moral stories, and they're going to pivot hard to superheroes, and that's when the romance kind of gets left behind, I think, from mainstream, from what's going to become the big two publishers, DC and Marvel.
At Ability Chiropractic, we believe every child deserves to grow up healthy, strong, and connected to the incredible power within their own body. From infants to adults, our doctors specialize in purposeful chiropractic care that restores balance between the brain and body, helping you and your family live and heal the way you were designed to, naturally. Families across Columbus are choosing to build lifelong wellness from the start. Discover what true health feels like at Ability Chiropractic. Schedule your visit today at abilitychiro.com.
Your check, your cooperative. As a farmer-owned lender, Farm Credit Mid-America shares the success of the cooperative with our customers, which is why we've returned more than $1.5 billion back to our customer owners over the last 9 years. It's proof being a part of our cooperative pays. Patronage is an annual decision made by the board of directors to return earnings to eligible customers. To learn more about patronage and eligibility, visit fcma.com/patronage.
I wonder if the appeal of romance novels is so much innuendo, and in comic books, you would have to draw it. You'd have to draw the heaving bosom, and you'd have to, I mean, the implication of them doing it is not the same if you don't have the picture.
With the visual, the visual right there, you'd have to be much more circumspect in how you're going to go about it. There's still, like Stan Lee, who we're going to associate with Marvel superheroes in an incredible way here very soon. But in the 50s, he's penning like these, like Millie the Model comic, he's writing, the script for, which is like the teen adventures of this girl and her, kind of like an Archie Betty Veronica kind of thing, she has a rival and a boy she's interested in every issue. And how's that going to go? But it's a very chaste romance. It's not like the heaving bosom romance novel that you're describing there.
It's true what you say, that it's very present in Archie. Archie is almost 100%, not 100%, but it's 50% a romance comic book.
Mm-hmm.
And then, there's Little Annie Fanny, but I guess we'll talk about her later too.
There's this period after the Comics Code Authority gets established and really is going to say you can't do the crime comics, and it's like the true crime podcast wave. It's like a lot of those crime comics were like inspired by true stories kind of things, and then you had the company called EC Comics doing a lot of the horror, Tales from the Crypt and those things. And it's when EC, because the Comics Code Authority essentially can't publish what they were doing, they're going to pivot to Mad Magazine, because it's going to be a magazine. It's not going to have to go through the Comics Code Authority.
Oh, interesting. I didn't think about it that way, but why did the fact that it was a magazine circumvent the Comics Code?
Because the magazine industry is not the comic book industry. They didn't have to go through the CCA the same way.
It's sort of like the way the government gets around certain laws by just calling things by different names, right?
And it's going to be a slightly different format. Like a Mad Magazine's larger and different page count in the comics, and it's going to have different content than what you find in a comic book, And so they argue this isn't a comic book, so we don't have to, submit to the Comics Code Authority.
Oh, well done, Mad Magazine. Well done, Harvey Kurtzman.
So in that period, so Jack Kirby had done Captain America during the war. He goes, fights in the war. When he comes back, he's willing to do whatever genre will sell. So he does romance comics. He and Joe Simon are going to stop working together so much, and he's going to end up working at the company that will become Marvel Comics with Stan Lee. And he does a lot of like monster comics is kind of what they do. Oh. After the Comics Code Authority, those kind of pivot to becoming like sci-fi comics with a little morality tale, like a little Aesop's Fable ending that teaches some lesson, so that they can say this is a good moral story that that they're publishing. And he draws lots of like aliens and monsters
like
in that
Twilight
era.
Zone kind of but like, so what if you can't have a monster comic but you can have a superhero comic where he's fighting kind of what I guess you would describe as monsters?
Well, it depends on what monsters you're going to end up fighting. So, like, there's an issue of the X-Men in the 60s where they meet Frankenstein's monster, but this turns out to be an alien android, because robots and aliens are allowed, that inspired Mary Shelley to write Frankenstein, is what they say. It's not actually Frankenstein's monster.
A time-traveling robot monster.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, sure.
And that's allowed. But if it had been a zombie, which Frankenstein's monster would have been, a zombie, that would not have been allowed until some loosening of the Comics Code Authority doesn't come around till the 70s. There's waves of how much they loosen the Comics Code Authority, and it's gone entirely now. But Jack Kirby and Stan Lee are going to co-create a lot of the Marvel universe here in the 60s when they decide that superheroes are where the kids are most interested. Like, this is the genre that's going to sell the most. And, like I said, this was not any grand plan that we're going to build some cohesive, massive universe. It's just the trend seems to be going towards superheroes. Over at DC, they had never stopped publishing Batman, Superman, and Wonder Woman from the Golden Age, but they had stopped publishing the Flash, but they reintroduced the Flash after the Comics Code Authority gets introduced. So they're like, we're going to make Flash. He's going to be a police scientist. No one knows what a police scientist is, but he's going to be a police scientist because that means he's a moral authority figure. And we're going to reintroduce the super speed stuff, and we're going to give him a cool new costume, and Flash sells really well. And they're like, well, let's put them all together as the Justice League, and let's bring back some of those other old Golden Age superheroes from the 1940s. And that does really well for DC. So over at the company that's about to become Marvel Comics, they're like, well, superheroes are selling well for this arrival. Let's try superheroes. And so Jack Kirby and Stanley are going to co-create the Fantastic Four. And then in pretty quick succession, they're going to make in the next few years Hulk, Iron Man, Marvel's version of Thor, the Avengers, the X-Men. Those are all co-creations of Jack Kirby. Like his art is defining these. And in those series, they're going to introduce the Black Panther, Dr. Doom, Galactus, Silver Surfer, all here in the early 60s. And Jack Kirby is like the core visual presence here at Marvel. And he's drawing all these comics. This is this incredible amount of output. And there's no sense that this is anything different than what they've done before, which is just chase the trend. This will go for 4 or 5 years and then it'll end and we'll be drawing or writing whatever the next, you know, genre trend is.
So when Jack Kirby invents, let's say the Hulk, does the Hulk come out of Jack Kirby sitting down and drawing a big green Hulk and then they invent a backstory, or is it coming out of a story and then he gives life to it as the Hulk?
Oh, you are hitting into the major issue of what was called the Marvel method of creation at the time. So Marvel, because of some contract issues, was only able to put out 8 comics a month. Stan Lee is going to be the writer on almost all of these comics. He's going to write the dialogue that appears in all of those, but he's not going to write a script for every issue. He's going to employ the Marvel method, which is have a quick story conference with Jack Kirby or Steve Ditko and say, okay, we're going to do in this issue of the Fantastic Four, I want to fight a bad guy called the Mole Man. He's going to be some underground guy. He's going to have some minions and he's going to come up and attack New York and the Fantastic Four beat him. And that's it. And then Jack Kirby goes and draws 22 pages of that.
You're kidding.
And hands it back to Stan Lee and Stan Lee puts in dialogue on top of those panels.
So Jack Kirby draws it with no idea what they're saying to one another.
And he will put in notes of his suggested dialogue. Sometimes Stan Lee uses those notes. Sometimes he ignores them completely. And when we're talking about what was at the time was completely disposable entertainment, where it's like, we're just getting this product out. We're going to go print 100,000 copies of this. We're going to sell it for a dime. And then we're just going to make the next one. No one cares that much about credit. But when these characters start to get adapted into other media, start to appear on merchandise, start to become intellectual property that can be worth today billions of dollars, it starts to become very important. Who created that thing? And when so much of the early Marvel universe was this kind of co-creation of a writer and an artist, the artist typically being on work for hire contract where they get paid for the pages they turn in, and Stan Lee being the editor that's a salaried position, there's very different contractual aspects of who's going to get credit. And this becomes a very sore point as Marvel superheroes continue to grow in popularity. So like throughout the 60s, Jack Kirby's going to start wanting more credit as a co-plotter or a, you know, a, like, hey, I'm creating these stories.
Right.
He will often, as it goes on, like it'll say co-plotter instead of artist. This is, I can't tell you the number of debates that still rage to this day about who deserves credit as the creator of not just like the title characters, but all the other, like all the villains that appear, who actually created, you know, these. So like a famous example is the Silver Surfer that you already mentioned, this philosophizing alien that rides around through space on a surfboard. The story, and this is, I will just say, like all of these have hearsay and people are telling their versions of what happened to try and make it look like their claim is more right. So this is all very muddy and messy. And I'm sure everything I say will be picked. If like a comic book fan or historian gets into this, they're going to say, well, it's not quite right on this. But the story goes that Stan Lee told Jack Kirby, I want Fantastic Four to fight God. And that was pretty much the outline that he was given. And then Jack Kirby goes and creates Galactus and the Silver Surfer. And Stan Lee gets the pages and he's like, who is this silver guy on a surfboard? Or, well, like, who's this guy on a surfboard? Like, it wasn't colored yet, but like, we didn't talk about this guy on a surfboard. And Jack Kirby's like, it's the Silver Surfer. He's the herald of Galactus, the god that they're fighting.
Right. Surfing would have been very prominent in American culture in the 60s. It would have been a real tie-in.
So Stanley ends up scripting the first appearance of Silver Surfer, but from that history, it sounds like Silver Surfer should be a Jack Kirby creation, right? You know, he'd been given this very loose outline and came back with art that featured a character that hadn't been mentioned in the outline at all. But if you look up Silver Surfer, it generally will say co-created by Stanley and Jack Kirby.
So when you think about comics as a disposable media and something where they were just cranking them out and they put them up on the little spiral rack at the drugstore and then they sold them and they went on to the next. At what point, because this was true of record albums, this was true of books, 98% of those things don't go to a second pressing. And that's why Superman number one is worth all this money, because there aren't that many of them. And that's why record collectors prefer these unknown. So when did comics start going into multiple pressings? When did they start being that edition would always be available thenceforth?
So there's the history is that in the 70s, you start to get to see the comic book store, a dedicated space that is always selling comics. Whereas before, like you said, it was on the drugstore racks. It was wherever magazines were sold. It's just kind of like where the publishers could get them in. And that was typically wherever they were also selling magazines. That's where you could find comic books, but it could be very irregular. Like you might not see, Amazing Spider-Man number 7 because they forgot to order it. And that was it. You were never going to see Amazing Spider-Man number 7. Right. And then in the 70s, you start to see the emergence of comic book stores, which is good and bad for the industry, right? One thing that it's going to do that is great is they're going to, instead of pulping their back issues and getting credit from the publisher, which is what the drugstores would do,
right?
And they send in torn covers to say, hey, we didn't sell these, so give us, 8 issues of the next one. But you had to prove you had pulped them. The comic book store says, well, we'll just hold that and eventually we'll sell it. Someone's going to come by that doesn't have it and they'll want it. And that's great. But it also makes it so that you're going to be less likely to casually encounter comic books, right? If it's at the drugstore, if it's at the grocery store checkout line, a first time kid can just find it and say, this is amazing. But as the industry shifts more and more to focus on the comic book store, it's got to be like, I need to enter this dedicated space. That feels a little gatekeepery to discover comics.
Oh, so yeah. Comics were then, they didn't appear in drugstores? Because I feel like
they do
remember,
through the 90s, but yeah. Kind of in the 2000s is where it goes away. And that's where now it's kind of become like, if you want to go find comic books, I mean, obviously you can order them online, but like if you want to go find them in your town, a kid has to make a choice to walk into a comic book store. Whereas I found my first comic book in the 90s at the grocery store. Yeah. When my mom wanted to keep me quiet while she was shopping, she let me go grab
one. Exactly. I remember having a big dispute with my dad about a thing that becomes a cultural signifier, which is that I said, can I have a couple of comics? He said yes, while he went off and bought shaving cream. And he came back and I had 3 comics. And he said, you said a couple. And I said, a couple is 3. And he said, a couple is not 3. And so you get no comics. And I said, a couple is 3, a couple. I mean, if I had meant 2, I would have said 2. And even at 8 years old, I was already part of this culture of people that believe that a couple means anywhere
very
between
specific.
2 and 4. And my dad, who arguably would have raised me to believe that a couple is 2. So I don't know. So yeah, I was still getting comics on racks until I stopped reading comics. So it hadn't occurred to me that stores.
So as the comic book store starts to become more of the place, like a repository for the old issues, it starts to become, well, those old issues, you're not going to just pay the cover price. Like we've been holding them for years. So now you got to pay 2-3 times the cover price and the old comic books start to go up in value. And this is going to lead to the speculator market of, well, I want to buy these while it's cheap. It's going to be the first appearance of this character. That character's going to be huge. I'm going to hold on to that. And that's really going to take root in the 80s and 90s, particularly in the 90s. It's going to lead to a speculation boom that's going to break the industry.
People lost their fortunes, right, in investing in comics as the Beanie Babies of their moment.
Oh, yeah. And that what happens, though, is they, here in the 70s and 80s, they're looking at like, well, that first appearance of Superman that cost a nickel when it first came out, it sold for tens of thousands, then hundreds of thousands. Today, it would be millions of dollars. If they ever sell a copy of Action Comics number 1, that does sell for millions of dollars. Like, well, the old comics are valuable. Therefore, if I buy these and they become old, they will become valuable. But everyone was treating it as trash, in that golden age. And literally there were paper drives where people, like, it was their patriotic duty to go destroy their comic books. We got to go turn these in. So like there's a rarity and scarcity that drives up those golden age. And even in the early silver age, there's no sense that these are going to become the foundation of multi-billion dollar franchises. The first appearance of Spider-Man or X-Men or whatever it is, it just comes and goes. And maybe this one's going to stick. And, a lot of them don't. And so no one's buying those to save. But then once the comic book store is there and people start thinking, I'm going to buy these to save, well, everyone's doing that. So, you know, some of the highest selling comic books in history are going to come in the early 90s, where they're really feeding the speculator boom with X-Men number one or The Death of Superman. And you can go find those issues for cover price on eBay, because so many were put out into the market, so many were bought and saved that, you know, 30 years later, there's been no change in the price point of those. It's those earlier ones that had no sense that this was going to be an investment, you know, that if you do, if you were some lucky kid who happened to hold on to it and didn't tear it up, then those ones are the ones that are worth a lot of money. And in that early Silver Age era of Marvel Comics creating the foundation of what has become, you know, massive pop culture franchises for us today, Jack Kirby is so responsible for this incredible amount of output by Marvel Comics. Like, the amount of pages that he drew just dwarfs the output of modern comic book artists. He was so busy and putting out so much content. And he was called, like, Stan Lee was giving monikers and nicknames to everyone. He was Jack King Kirby, and he's still called the King. You know, he's the King of Comics, not just because of the amount that he was putting out, but like his character design. Like, he's the designer of so many core Marvel characters because he was the first one to draw them. But then also his storytelling on the pages was considered like he's the one that figured out how to use these panels to tell action. So like his original art would be like when Marvel was getting new artists, they're like, go look at these Jack Kirby pages, see how he does the panel layout, how he moves the quote unquote camera, you know, between these, how he positions the characters, how he leaves room for the word balloons. You know, everything that he does is right. You know, how he draws action, how he paces the page. Cause like I said, Stanley often wasn't giving him an outline of like, on this page, I want six panels. On this page, I want five. On this page, I want it to be a splash page. Jack Kirby was figuring that out, but he'd like put the splash page of the big moment and the big reveal at just the right spot. So like new artists, we told like, study how Jack does this.
And who was the first artist that broke the frame of the, you know, of the box, right? You see them, see action start to come outside of the lines.
Yeah, doing the full bleed to the end. I'm not sure. I'm sure Eisner probably did some of that in the Spirit, because he would do very interesting, unique panel layouts. And occasionally, I mean, most superhero comics are going to have some sort of splash page, and a lot of those are going to be the full bleeds. But you can definitely find examples of Jack Kirby, like okay, on this this panel only actually has two sides, and the other side it's like coming out to the bottom, and like right. the sides that are there to guide your eyes. Like he never messes up the eye line, because that's something that so many new comics artists struggle with, because it's not
messes up the eye line. What does that mean?
It's laying out the panels so that your eye naturally progresses from the one panel to the next in the right order.
Oh, I see.
And it's very easy to do that incorrectly.
Yeah, because I've had that
reading left to right, top to bottom. Yeah,
reading comic books where I'm like, where am I now? What? How am I over here?
And you just want it to feel natural. You don't want to pull the reader out at any point. And Jack Kirby had a very intuitive sense and also a practice sense. Like, if this was his job that he did, you know, thousands, tens of thousands of times that he drew pages, that he knew exactly how to lay things out so that the eye was always going to the right spot. And so in this era in the 60s, he is just churning out so much content for Marvel. And it's while he's still doing that, that they're starting to realize this is different than us chasing those earlier fads. These characters are enduring. We're building a narrative universe here that's shared. And also Stanley's starting to look at, can we adapt these into cartoons? You know, can we move into other media that's going to make these characters more lucrative? And that's going to start to cause some rankling of Jack Kirby saying, like, well, where's my share of this bigger pie that started to come about?
Let me ask you about the narrative universe. Like, it would seem that in the early days there wouldn't have been like a master plan, that from issue to issue people would have different powers or different backstories, or there wouldn't be that continuity. Was there continuity the whole time just because it just sort of naturally flowed, that it was only being written by two guys, and so they kind of knew their own tale?
That's a big part of it, is it was just such a small circle that was actively involved in shepherding these early Marvel comics, that Stan Lee initially is going to be able to kind of keep an eye on everything, because he's scripting most of these. His brother's going to start scripting some. A guy named Roy Thomas is going to come in. He was an English high school teacher that got really into comics, and he's going to come in and start writing and also become an editor that kind of helps to keep an eye on this continuity. But also, like, Jack Kirby is He's able to keep like the Fantastic Four powers so consistent because he's the only one that draws the Fantastic Four for 100 issues. You know, it's just him. And so he's able to ensure some level of consistency throughout the Marvel universe. He's also going to draw a lot of these like early crossovers. Again, like I cannot understand how he produces as much content as he does. It is just so much art that he is able to put out.
This must be part of the lore too, but forgive me for not knowing it, but how able is he? How much does his quality vary? I know with a lot of comic book or a lot of artists of all kinds, but particularly comic artists, you know, from panel to panel, it's got to be hard to keep just the person looking like the same person.
Yeah, he has a very distinctive style. Like when you look at Kirby art, you know it's Kirby. It's kind of a blockier, stocky kind of figure that he does. A little more angular in the face, not quite like as angular as like the Dick Tracy art that you would see, you know. But still, it's something that's distinctively Kirby, and his style was pretty consistent as he's going through. So because his like the way he draws the human face was so consistent, there's not huge variance. Now, one thing that he does in putting out this much content is sometimes at like the top of a page of Fantastic Four, he'll draw in like the setting where the scene is taking place. But then when you get to the actual panels of the conversation, there's no background, and that's a way to save time, right? But I gave you the like, you know, they're in this building because I gave you the setup scene. But now I'm just going to draw the faces for the next five panels.
Oh, right.
And leave space for word balloon, but the colorist is just going to put like a blank color behind. Like it's just a pale red, you know, behind Mr. Fantastic.
Yeah, I can picture that.
And the word blue. Yeah.
Because he does set the scene so artfully. I mean, when I say I'm not a fan of this stuff or familiar with it, of course it's in the culture and has been my whole life. So I know so much of it just through this osmosis, cultural osmosis.
But there's also the difference. So he's the penciler, but then an inker comes over and puts all the black lines that are going to become the black plate for the printing process. So depending on who the inker was, they may do more or less details from his pencils.
The inker does the black lines? I always assumed the inker just did the color. So the original drawing is what, in pencil?
Yeah. So Jack Kirby is a pencilist. An inker is going to go in and ink the lines that are going to become the black plate, the last plate for printing that go over everything. There's also the colorist and the letterer that are all part of getting the page ready, the color giving the codes, which depending on what era we're talking about, there's a different range of colors that are even available to them, right, to be able to put in. And now this is all different, of course, because of digital art and color and printing. Now there's a million colors that is available to a colorist, but back in the 60s it was we're going to the four color plate printing, so choose wisely and how you want to combine those.
So these guys are disputing ownership, but is it because they are suddenly rich? Who's the first person to get rich?
So Marvel, the company, is going to be sold in 68 to I think it's called Cadence. It's one of these conglomerates that's just starting to buy up a bunch of companies that might be valuable,
All right, Gulf and Western. Yeah.
Yes. And at that point, there's this kind of recognition that these characters might endure. Stanley is obviously going to be, again, because of the nature of his contract, he's seeing a different kind of payout. Whereas the people that did all the work for hire, they do not get, sudden new bonuses. Like Jack Kirby's probably able to negotiate like a higher page rate as things go on, but he's not seeing residuals on these characters as they get adapted into animation, and stuff like that. And so he's going to start asking for that. And this is also that era in the late 60s and early 70s where the comic stores are going to start emerging, and there's interest in the value of old issues is going up. And there's also the first comic book conventions are going to be happening. And that's where you start to see things like original art being sold for the first time ever. Like there was no place to do that. There was no sense that those original pencils that Jack Kirby was churning out so many of were going to have value as pieces of the production process, because it was just part of the production process.
Did he keep most of those after they went to press? Did he keep his art?
So all the art goes back to Marvel. And this is where we're going to get into the issue of Jack Kirby's lost art. So it is estimated that in this era of the Silver Age, he produced about 10,000 pages of art for Marvel.
That's quite a stack.
Is going to go into a warehouse. It's just going to go sit in a warehouse. Now, when Marvel gets bought by Cadence, you know, that conglomerate company, there's question about, is that original art like part of the value of Marvel? And does the company now own it? Or does this belong to the artist? Now, this was not a consideration. No one thought the original art was going to have value. It's like when you did an episode with Ken about the Hollywood memorabilia sale.
Yeah.
And it's like, no one... You know, like, we're making a final product. That's where the money is. No one thinks like these random pieces that, you know, these shoes that appeared on screen are going to have any value. Like, who cares about that? I even saw like Steven Spielberg talk about this recently because there was a museum exhibit of that included like the buoy that was used in Jaws. And he's like, I never would have thought of grabbing the buoy because I was panicked. I was going to get fired the next day. Like who thought to save the buoy?
Right. And doesn't Spielberg actually own a pair of Dorothy's ruby slippers? Or I feel like
I think he does now.
He
would
figured
guess
it
if
out.
Anyone. Yeah. Yeah. But at this point, no one thinks that art is going to be valuable. It's sitting in a warehouse. And eventually, as Jack Kirby is going to leave Marvel and go work for DC, part of that is he starts to get angry that he can't get his original art back. Marvel won't give it to him. And there's, after he leaves Marvel, he's going to actually sue Marvel for both the rights to his characters that he says he created and his original art. There's a new editor-in-chief named Jim Shooter here in this late 70s and 80s who says, like, my policy was return the art to the artist, and that actually became the standard by the mid-70s, that all art does go back to the artist. But all that earlier stuff, because it was part of the sale of Marvel to this bigger conglomerate, like, it's all messy and the lawyers won't let him give it back to Jack Kirby. And they also say, if we give Jack Kirby back his art, that would be an admission of his lawsuit, that his lawsuit has validity, that therefore he owns the Fantastic Four and he owns the X-Men, he owns Magneto, he owns Doctor Doom.
Right.
So we can't give it back his original art. And there's this lawsuit that's ongoing that, from all reports, a lot of the people that worked at Marvel wanted to give him back the art, but the lawyers were saying, no, you can't because we bought it
right
as the new company.
At Ability Chiropractic, we believe every child deserves to grow up healthy, strong, and connected to the incredible power within their own body. From infants to adults, our doctors specialize in purposeful chiropractic care that restores balance between the brain and body, helping you and your family live and heal the way you were designed to, naturally. Families across Columbus are choosing to build lifelong wellness from the start. Discover what true health feels like at Ability Chiropractic. Schedule your visit today at abilitychiro.com.
Hello, I'm here during the lunch rush with Janice, who owns her own food truck.
Best cheesesteaks in town.
Janice traded up to Geico Commercial Auto Insurance for her food truck business. We're here where she needs us most.
They sure are.
We make it so easy for her to save with customized coverage that grows with her business. Sorry, I just get so emotional talking about saving folks money.
Not this onion I'm chopping?
It's just so beautiful. Oh yeah, no, it's the onion.
Get a commercial auto insurance quote today at geico.com and see how much you could save. Get more with Geico.
Well, you know, this is absolutely analogous to something in the music business, which is that when you go in to make a record and you are on a record company, the record itself that you make belongs to the record company. The songs don't.
Mm-hmm.
But the actual recordings do. And so you see these situations like with Prince or with Taylor Swift, where they don't actually own their own albums.
Right.
They own the songs, and sometimes they'll go and re-record an entire album and make it sound exactly like the old album. But because they paid for it themselves, they own the record, and they encourage people to listen to the new stuff. But that crazy aspect of the arts business where you don't own the thing you make when you make mm-hmm. it under contract is it comes up over and over.
Yeah, it's this meeting of art and commerce that is part of like the American media system now, where so much of our art is subsidized by these big production companies that are trying to make a profit of it. But then... What is artistic expression? What is the product? Who owns what? Seems to be something that constantly comes up as we discover that these things have value. Like in the 1960s, no one cared about this the original pencils. You know, right. I'm drawing this issue. I got my paycheck. Now I'm drawing the next issue. That's it.
So when you talk about Jack Kirby's lost art, the implication is that although these lawyers didn't want to return it to Jack Kirby, they also didn't keep a good handle on where it was.
Yeah. So eventually in around, I think it's 1987, Jack Kirby gets a settlement for Time. There'll be more lawsuits to come, but he gets a settlement and Marvel says, okay, we're going to return to you all your original art. And I can find online like reports that it was anywhere from 2,000 to 3,000 pieces of original art get returned. The estimate is that he had made 10,000 pieces of original art. So that 7,000 is the lost art. Like, what happened to these other pieces of Jack Kirby's original art that today is foundational for our popular culture, you know, is incredibly important for where the media landscape has gone. And it's just gone. And there's all sorts of stories, about where like some of these pieces may have gone. So, there are stories that in the '60s, if fans of Marvel Comics managed to find the Marvel offices listed in the phone book and went to visit and say, I love your stuff, they would just hand original art to the fans.
But wouldn't that stuff have turned up on the secondary market? I mean, now that it was all super valuable, I'm assuming.
Well, now it is, yes. And this is going to become very messy for that secondary market in a little bit because, so we know that some of it was just handed out to fans when they came and you wouldn't say that is stolen. We do know also that the warehouse where Marvel stored their original art in the 60s was not secure and also was not the ideal location for storing paper. And so right.
It was
a
full
lot
of mice.
Original art
it turns out it
was
had a,
damaged and
mice.
Destroyed. Like, yeah, wow. Damaged and destroyed is what the presumption is for a fair percentage of this art, that it just was lost because it was stored crappily. You know,
well, I've been to several Comic Cons and I mm-hmm. know, I know what happens in the dark, dark underbelly of a Comic Con. And so there must be complete cross referencing of the known art and the comic books in which they appeared and then all the missing art. So are there commonalities that the missing art shares, or do you look at an old comic book and it's like, well, we have that page and we have that page, but the rest we don't? And
it seems like a lot of the covers are definitely amongst the missing, which makes people suspect that some Marvel staffers really like those big pieces of art and just walked out with them. There's a journal called The Kirby Collector that is just all about Jack Kirby, his art, his original art. And there's a big article in there by a man named Glenn Gould about the Jack Kirby original art. And he tells the story that, like, we know in 1971 at one of the very first comic conventions, some Marvel staffers showed up and were just selling original art for $15 a pop. And there was no way they would have had the legal reason or permission to do this. So the assumption is they just walked out of the warehouse and went and sold this for their own personal profit. We do know, like I said, new artists would be handed Jack Kirby stuff as reference. A lot of that probably didn't get back to Marvel, where it's like, oh, I was just, you know, told to go do this. When that first wave of comic book stores are opening, it's believed that Marvel sent out original art as promotional items for them to be able to sell in their stores. Like, hey, I have some of this old stuff that we're not using here. There's a story that one of the early like licensees of Marvel stuff that was going to put it onto posters or t-shirts or whatever, they got sent a bunch of original art and then just never returned it. Like, you know, they'd cut out the panel, you know, blow that up, put it onto posters, and then, you know, keep the rest of it.
And that was presumably the best art, right? That they were making, that they were going to make posters and t-shirts of.
So that was going on. So Jim Shooter becomes Marvel editor-in-chief. And he has a story that in 1978, that warehouse was broken into. And he says, like, from what we could tell, we don't know that a whole lot was stolen, but everything was tossed around. So we don't actually know. Maybe a lot of art was stolen then. But he says, at that point, I ordered all the art taken out of that warehouse. We just say, that's not a good place to store this. And it's going to come to my office at Marvel because I've got a lock on my door, essentially. And so boxes and boxes of art just get stuck into the Marvel offices. But there's like, it didn't all fit into his office. There's stories that it was just sitting out there next to the elevator, like boxes of original art from the 60s. And this is now the late 70s, where there is a sense that this stuff is valuable. And so like he says, for sure, I know one box entirely disappeared. Like it just was gone. Like I saw it there one day and then it was gone the next.
Can you imagine getting on the elevator and you're like, huh, you know what? I'm just going to grab this box on my way out. And it's like a whole like year's worth of comic books.
Yeah. Original art from like, if it was from 1963, you know, it's original Avengers. Maybe it's original Avengers art. Who knows what it is. But it, like if it is valuable, even then it's all gone up in value now. And so when Jack Kirby gets only essentially 20%, maybe 30% of his art back, like he's still pretty angry about this.
Oh, sure. and he's got to be how old at this point? He's in his 70s? 60s?
Sixties by then. So he dies in 94, I think is when he's gonna die at 76, in 1994 when he's 76 years old. But then his heirs in the early 2000s are going to, because of some changes in copyright law, they have the option to try and cancel the copyright, of Work for Hire things. I'm not going to get into all the, I know enough. No, I don't know. Right. All the nuances here, but I know there's a lawsuit that goes through the court system and is about to go to the Supreme Court in, I want to say it's 2014. And this, by this point, Disney has bought Marvel. And Disney decides to settle rather than let the Supreme Court decide.
Okay. All right. Because they're afraid of a precedent, right? They don't want.
Yes.
Because this could open up a can of worms that would drive them nuts.
And no one knows exactly what the settlement is. There are all sorts of rumors about how big it is. But we know the heirs of Jack Kirby get taken care of and are no longer filing suit against Marvel and Disney. And then, so that's in 2014. And then there's an article by Augie DeBlick. B-L-I-E-K, I'm not 100% sure on the pronunciation of that name, that it says in 2016, people noticed that scans of that 1960 Jack Kirby art that people had on websites start getting taken down, and auction houses will no longer sell Jack Kirby stuff in the 1960s. Now, this is a little bit after that settlement with the Kirby estate. So the connecting the dots says Disney lawyers are starting to look into all this missing Jack Kirby art from the 1960s. Like I said, people start noticing, like people who have said, oh, I've got this piece. Suddenly there's no footprint of that online saying I've got this piece.
Oh, the last thing you want is a Disney detective knocking on your door. Like
Jack Kirby gets made a Disney legend in 2017 is part of this as well.
What's a Disney legend?
It's like their Disney Hall of Fame of like great creators that have helped make Disney what it is. Now, obviously Disney bought Marvel. You know, he wasn't working for Disney when he did all this, but now he's officially a Disney legend, which also makes people think like they're starting to pay more attention to this. And that, Augie DeBlick, he also said in 2024, he noticed that Heritage Auction House began selling Kirby art from the 60s. And he found a podcast episode with someone from Heritage who just said, as long as you prove it wasn't stolen, we have arrangements that we can sell this now, which again, like no one knows for sure, but speculation will be that maybe the Kirby estate is getting a piece of any sales from this 1960s Kirby art. But there's this era right after Disney settles with the Kirby estate that you can't find any of the 1960s art online anymore or being sold through auction houses anymore.
So I do follow a couple of comic book auction houses because I am interested in original comic art. I have a few framed, none right here, but I do kind of decorate my house with some original panels of alternative comics, and I've lost a couple of auctions for key pieces that I really, really wanted that some other ding-a-ling is probably has in their New York City loft. But I see stuff go up for auction all the time. It's a massive business now, and you see panels, mm-hmm. and some of these artists a lot less prominent than Jack Kirby. Their work is, you know, an original page of a comic book is $10,000 or more. What is an original page of 60s Jack Kirby worth?
So I went and looked, and what I could see as the most recent was a 1965 cover that was sold for over $600,000.
You're kidding.
And an interior page that was listed for $200,000.
You're kidding.
So when it's not just for Jack Kirby, like the seeming indignity and not being taken care of by a company that he helped to create. Like there's no denying that Jack Kirby is foundational for the superhero universe of Marvel. But now we're talking millions of dollars of, you know, actual money that disappeared in this era in the 1960s. If he had that and was able to sell it. Now, obviously some of these prices may be that high because it's so rare, right? You know, scarcity is going to drive this up. It is incredibly hard to get 1960s original Jack Kirby art for all the reasons that we've just discussed. So if it was all there and available and his family was like parceling it out in ways, maybe all these prices would be depressed far more than they are. But I will not be surprised if, you know, in my lifetime, you see a piece of Jack Kirby original art go for $1 million.
But it seems like this stuff is dwarfed by what Jack Kirby's intellectual property would be worth in creating the Marvel Comics universe. It would seem like that would be worth billions of dollars.
Oh, I mean, that's when Disney bought Marvel, it was for billions of dollars. You know, when they put out an Avengers movie, you know, how much money do they make? And, you know, Avengers is a co-creation of Jack Kirby. You know, so absolutely, like, the intellectual property side of it would be astronomical. You know, and it's just so fascinating that there was no idea that this is what they were doing. Like, this is just work for hire. I'm just doing my weekly job,
right?
Of making this.
But the suggestion of what you're saying is that all across America, somebody's got a little bin of old crapola, and they die, and their kid finds this milk crate, and in it are 5 Jack Kirby panels that are worth $600,000. Is that basically kind of what we're expecting?
I would guess a lot more of it ended up being destroyed or lost in that warehouse. Like you said, right, you know, mice, mold, we got to throw out the moldy pages, you know,
right.
That kind of thing, then actually walked out the door. You know, the speculation or that Glenn Gould article in the Kirby Collector mentions that, like, if you talk to anyone who worked or was connected to Marvel in the 1960s, they probably have a story about so-and-so has Fantastic Four number one on their wall right. In their house, and they just haven't told anyone. You know, just the rumors run rampant of you know, who walked out the door with what, essentially.
I mean, you think about this, there are so many people out there who, I mean, the people that are looking for sunken Spanish galleons and the millions and millions they spend to try and find a galleon. And part of it is, it's not just about the money, it's that the adventure, right? But there are people that spend their whole lives looking for meteorites. They're out with metal detectors. Mm-hmm. And that one guy that had all that Bitcoin on a hard drive and threw it away in some Australian dump.
Kept trying to find it.
Oh, they're digging up for years looking for this
but thing. Yeah, maybe there's a trove of Jack Kirby original art in someone's attic.
Right. This seems like a thing ripe for a certain kind of treasure hunter detective who's a really good researcher or a library science type person who would be, and maybe it's you who would say, like, you know what, I'm going to dedicate my life to, because all you'd have to do is find one box of these.
And it would be worth it.
It'd be worth it, right? You'd be set for forever with your, you know, just sort of trickling out these incredibly valuable missing pages. I wonder, wasn't there a guy in Colorado that hid some millions of dollars worth of rubies or something in the mountains?
And
he had some puzzle. This seems like a good omnibus episode. He had some puzzle that people had to find, and here it is. This is the big treasure hunt of our era.
I mean, it's just, like I said, 10,000 pages. We know where 2,000 to 3,000 of them are, and then I'm sure that the Jack Kirby Collector magazine could track down hundreds of others that are known. Like, this collector has this. This person bought it here, but it's got to be thousands that are still just either destroyed or sitting out there hidden away because they know they weren't supposed to have them, and they're just sitting in someone's closet.
Wow. Well, I'm gonna stop looking for rare R. Crumb drawings, and I'm gonna start looking for Jack Kirby drawings. Where would I start? They're not in Seattle, I'll tell you that. They're all covered with mold, the ones that were here. They got thrown away a long time ago. Well, Joe, this has been a great episode. Was there anything that you wanted to cover that we didn't get around to?
I just wanted to shout out how incredibly important Jack Kirby is as a storyteller, but also just his artistic style. There's an academic named Charles Hatfield who coined the term the cosmic sublime for some of Jack Kirby's stuff, like when the Fantastic Four go into outer space, and it's just Jack Kirby did some experimental, art style just to try and create a sense of wonder. And you look at it and you're like, this is unlike anything I've ever seen before. And I love that term cosmic sublime for it. And there's, other things, like he does this thing that's called Kirby Crackle, which is the way he drew energy, around all the weird inventions of Mr. Fantastic. And, Kirby Crackle is still like a part of comic book art. So besides like creating so many key characters that are a part of our cultural landscape. Like his visual aesthetic is still part of, the way that we tell these fantastic stories in comic books and in all the adaptations of comic books. It's one of those, like just through cultural literacy, you're familiar with Jack Kirby stories and characters, even if you've never like sat down and read a comic book. Like, oh yeah, I know, I know who Iron Man is, or I know who the X-Men are. I know who Magneto is. That's, it goes back to this creator that's one of the, like the unsung architects of our entertainment industry today, essentially.
Can you think of another artist in any media that was as prolific?
Oh, I nothing is going to come immediately to mind. I'm sure your listeners can probably give some examples.
Keith Haring made a lot of stuff, but it wasn't like such a breadth of cultural output.
Yeah, right? And there were some dime novelists that were just churning out the next dime novel every month. Here's another 5,000 word dime novel story, and they just did that till they died.
But they didn't, some things like that. Change all of literature or even invent whole genres, presumably.
Yeah. And their stuff isn't currently, a billion-dollar foundation for a mega media empire.
Right. Oh, God, isn't that fascinating? Well, I wish you the best of luck in finding some of Jack Kirby's lost art. I know I'm going to be searching for it in every garage sale and every thrift store that I go to from now on. Just like I won't skip over that stuff. I'll beeline for it.
If I do, you will never find out that I discovered it.
Right, because those Disney detectives are probably listening to this show and like, I don't know. They've talked about it enough now. We're gonna have to start bleeping his name. Well, Joe, thank you so much for coming on the show. Welcome to the Omnibus. This is absolutely going to be entered into the platinum records that we're storing deep in the Utah mountains that will one day, I guess, be by the time futurelings actually listen to this episode, it may be that Jack Kirby is regarded sort of Bill and Ted style as an actual god. And the whole religion of the Marvel Comics universe that dominates the sentient octopi that run the universe.
Well, thank you for having me on. I was very excited to be able to talk about Jack Kirby's lost art.
And that concludes Jack Kirby's lost art, entry 688.DE2203. Certificate number 43383 in the Omnibus. Futurelings, as you know, social media is an unholy trash fire and we disavow it. Yet we contribute to Facebook and Instagram at Omnibus Project. Fans of the show congregate on Reddit, Discord, Facebook, and elsewhere under the group sobriquet Futurelings. And you can find them threaded throughout the internet under that search term. Our address for email, which was a popular form of written electronic communication in your distant past, was and is theomnibusproject@gmail.com. Physical mail, postcards, packages, and talismans may be sent care of the Omnibus Project to 609 Southwest 150th Street, number 48084, Burien, Washington, 98166-998. Our show is listener supported, so please continue joining our Patreon community at patreon.com/omnibusproject. Membership in that community comes with a treasure trove of perks, including years of photos, show notes, outtakes, studio shots, and mail, as well as monthly addenda episodes featuring emeritus co-host Ken Jennings, and depending on the level of subscription, perks including executive and exclusive merch items and bonuses. All Patreon members get early access to weekly episodes on Tuesdays instead of Thursdays. Well worth the money. That's patreon.com/omnibusproject.
Futurelings, from our vantage point in your distant past, we have no idea how long our civilization survived. We hope and pray that the catastrophe we fear may never come. If the worst comes soon, this recording, like all our recordings, may have been our final word. whatever Providence allows. We wish you many fluids and cheese and hope to be back with you soon for another entry in the Omnibus.
At Ability Chiropractic, we believe every child deserves to grow up healthy, strong, and connected to the incredible power within their own body. From infants to adults, our doctors specialize in purposeful chiropractic care that restores balance between the brain and body, helping you and your family live and heal the way you were designed to, naturally. Families across Columbus are choosing to build lifelong wellness from the start. Discover what true health feels like at Ability Chiropractic. Schedule your visit today at abilitychiro.com.
I'm here on the job site with Dale, who's a framing contractor.
Hey, good morning.
Dale traded up to Geico Commercial Auto Insurance for all his business vehicles. We're here where he needs us most.
Yep, they sure are.
We make it easy for him to save on all his insurance needs, all in one place, with coverage that fits his business and bottom line. Oh, I shouldn't have looked down.
It's all right.
We're so far up here.
Look at me. Take a deep breath.
No, I'm good. So good.
Get a commercial auto insurance quote today at Geico.com and see how much you could save. Get more with Geico.
Worried about your future in tech? Master new skills. Accelerate your team's impact. And redefine what's possible with Pluralsight. We're more than just another online learning platform. We're shattering the skills gap and shaping future generations of technologists. Transform your work. Transform your team. Ready to tap in? Visit us at Pluralsight.com to learn more.